how wonderful this new addition to the Imperial Library might prove to be. When it was exposed to view, however, the air in the room thickened with disappointment.
"What joke is this?"
Rudolf snapped in German.
"I'm not sure I take your Majesty's meaning," Matthew replied.
He waited for Galloglass to translate.
"I mean that I already know this book,"
Rudolf sputtered.
"That doesn't surprise me, Your Majesty, since you gave it to John Dee, by mistake, I am told."
Matthew bowed.
"The Emperor does not make mistakes,"
Strada said, pushing the book away in disgust.
"We all make mistakes, Signor Strada," Hayek said gently. "I am sure, though, that there is some other explanation as to why this book has been returned to the Emperor. Perhaps Dr. Dee uncovered its secrets."
"It is nothing but childish pictures," retorted Strada.
"Is that why this picture book found its way into Dr. Dee's baggage? Did you hope he would be able to understand what you could not?"
Matthew's words were having an adverse effect on Strada, who turned purple.
"Perhaps you borrowed Dee's book, Signor Strada, the one with alchemical pictures from Roger Bacon's library, in hope that it would help you decipher this one. That is a far more pleasant prospect than imagining you would have tricked poor Dr. Dee out of his treasure. Of course, His Majesty could not have known of such an evil business."
Matthew's smile was chilling.
"And is this book that you say I have the only treasure of mine you wish to take back to England?"
Rudolf asked sharply.
"Or does your avarice extend to my laboratories?"
"If you mean Edward Kelly, the Queen needs some assurance that he is here of his own free will. Nothing more," Matthew lied.
He then took the conversation in a less trying direction.
"Do you like your new altarpiece, Your Majesty?"
Matthew had provided the Emperor just enough room to regroup and save face.
"The boss is exceptional. My uncle will be most aggrieved to learn that I have acquired it."
Rudolf looked around.
"Alas, this room is not suitable for its display. I wanted to show it to the Spanish ambassador, but here you cannot get far enough from the painting to view it properly. It is a work that you must come upon slowly, allowing the details to emerge naturally. Come, see where I have put it."
Matthew and Galloglass arranged themselves so that Rudolf couldn't get too close to me as we trooped through the door and into a room that looked like the storeroom for an overstuffed and understaffed museum. Shelves and cabinets held so many shells, books, and fossils that they threatened to topple over. Huge canvases, including the new painting of Venus, which was not simply detailed but openly erotic, were propped up against bronze statues. This must be Rudolf's famed curiosity cabinet, his room of wonders and marvels.
"Your Majesty needs more space."
"Or fewer specimens," Matthew commented, grabbing a piece of porcelain to keep it from smashing to the floor.
"I will always find a place for new treasures."
The Emperor's gaze settled on me once more.
"I am building 4 new rooms to hold them all. You can see them working."
He pointed out the window to 2 towers and the long building that was beginning to connect them to the Emperor's apartments and another new piece of construction opposite.
"Until then, Ottavio and Tadeusz are cataloging my collection and instructing the architects on what I require. I do not want to move everything into the new Kunstkammer only to outgrow it again."
Rudolf led us through a warren of additional storerooms until we finally arrived at a long gallery with windows on both sides. It was full of light, and after the gloom and dust of the preceding chambers, entering it felt like taking in a lungful of clean air. The sight in the center of the room brought me up short. Matthew's altarpiece sat open on a long table covered with thick green felt. The Emperor was right. You couldn't fully appreciate the colors when you stood close to the work.
"It is beautiful, Doña Diana."
Rudolf took advantage of my surprise to grasp my hand.
"Notice how what you perceive changes with each step. Only vulgar objects can be seen at once, for they have no mysteries to reveal."
Strada looked at me with open animosity, Hayek with pity. Matthew was not looking at me at all, but at the Emperor.
"Speaking of which, Majesty, might I see Dee's book?"
Matthew's expression was guileless, but no one in the room was fooled for an instant. The wolf was on the prowl.
knows where it is?
Rudolph had to drop my hand in order to wave vaguely at the rooms we had just left.
Signor Strada must be neglecting his duties if such a precious manuscript cannot be found when the Emperor requires it, Matthew said softly.
Ottavio is very busy at present with matters of importance.
Rudolph glared at Matthew.
And I do not trust Dr. D. Your queen should be aware of his false promises.
But you trust Kelly? Perhaps he knows its whereabouts. At this, the Emperor looked distinctly uneasy.
I do not want Edward disturbed. He is at a very delicate stage in the alchemical work.
Prague has many charms, and Diana has been commissioned to purchase some alchemical glassware for the Countess of Pembroke. We will occupy ourselves with that task until Sir Edward is able to receive visitors. Perhaps Signor Strada will be able to find your missing book by then.
This Countess of Pembroke is the sister of the Queen's hero, Sir Philip Sidney?
Rudolph asked, his interest caught. When Matthew opened his mouth to answer, Rudolph stopped him with a raised hand.
It is Doña Diana's business. We will let her answer.
Yes, Your Majesty, I responded in Spanish. My pronunciation was atrocious. I hoped that would diminish his interest.
Charming,
Rudolph murmured. Damn.
Very well, then, Doña Diana must visit my workshops. I enjoy fulfilling a lady's wishes.
It wasn't clear which lady he meant.
As for Kelly and the book, we shall see, we shall see.
Rudolph turned back to the triptych.
I will see, be silent, and hear. Isn't that the proverb?
Chapter 28.
Did you see the werewolf, Frau Royden? He is the Emperor's gamekeeper, and my neighbor Frau Habermel has heard him howling at night. They say he feeds on the imperial deer running in the stag moat.
Frau Huber picked up a cabbage in her gloved hand and gave it a suspicious sniff. Herr Huber had been a merchant at London's steelyard, and though she bore no love for the city, she spoke English fluently.
Pah! There is no werewolf, Signorina Rossi said, turning her long neck and tutting over the price of the onions.
My Stefano tells me there are many demons in the palace, however. The bishops at the cathedral wish to exorcise them, but the emperor refuses.
Like Frau Huber, Rossi had spent time in London. Then she had been mistress to an Italian artist who wanted to bring mannerism to the English. Now she was mistress to another Italian artist who wanted to introduce the art of glass cutting to Prague. I saw no werewolves or demons, I confessed. The women's faces fell. But I did see one of the Emperor's new paintings. I dropped my voice. It showed Venus, rising from her bath. I gave them both significant looks. In the absence of otherworldly gossip, the perversions of royalty would suffice. Frau Huber drew herself straight.
Emperor Rudolph needs a wife, a good Austrian woman who will cook for him.
She condescended to buy a cabbage from the grateful vegetable seller, who had been putting up with her criticism of his produce for nearly 30 minutes.
Tell us again about the unicorn's horn. It's supposed to have miraculous curative powers.
It was the fourth time in 2 days I'd been asked to account for the marvels among the Emperor's curiosities. News of our admittance to Rudolph's private apartments preceded our return to the Three Ravens, and the ladies of Malastrana were lying in wait the next morning, eager for my impressions. Since then, the appearance of imperial messengers at the house, as well as the liveried servants of dozens of Bohemian aristocrats and foreign dignitaries, had roused their curiosity further. Now that Matthew had been received at court, his star was sufficiently secure in the imperial heavens that his old friends were willing to acknowledge his arrival and ask for his help. Pierre pulled out the ledgers, and soon the Prague branch of the de Clermont Bank was open for business, though I saw precious little money received and a steady stream of funds flow out to settle overdue accounts with the merchants of Prague's old town. You received a package from the Emperor, Matthew told me when I returned from the market. He pointed with his quill at a lumpy sack. If you open it, Rudolph will expect you to express your thanks personally.
What could it be? I felt the outlines of the object inside. It wasn't a book.
Something will regret receiving, I warrant. Matthew jammed the quill in the ink pot, causing a minor eruption of thick black liquid onto the surface of the desk. Rudolph is a collector, Diana, and is not simply interested in narwhal horns and bezoar stones. He covets people as well as objects, and is just as unlikely to part with them once they're in his possession.
Like Kelly, I said, loosening the parcel strings. But I'm not for sale.
We are all for sale.
Matthew's eyes widened.
Good Christ!
A 2-foot-tall, gold and silver statue of the goddess Diana sat between us, naked except for her quiver, riding side-saddle on the back of a stag with her ankles demurely crossed. A pair of hunting dogs sat at her feet.
Galloglass whistled. Well, I'd say the Emperor has made his desires known in this case.
But I was too busy studying the statue to pay much attention. A small key was embedded in the base. I gave it a turn, and the stag took off across the floor.
Look, Matthew, did you see that?
You're in no danger of losing Uncle's attention, Galloglass assured me.
It was true. Matthew was staring angrily at the statue.
Whoa, young Jack.
Galloglass caught Jack by the collar as the boy sped into the room. But Jack was a professional thief, and such delaying tactics were of little use when he smelled something of value. He slid to the floor in a boneless heap, leaving Galloglass holding the jacket, and sprang after the deer.
Is it a toy? Is it for me? Why is that lady not wearing any clothes? Isn't she cold?
The questions poured out of Jack in an unbroken torrent. Teresa, who was as interested in spectacle as any of the other women in Malastrana, came to see what the fuss was about. She gasped at the naked woman in her employer's office and clapped her hand over Jack's eyes. Galloglass peered at the statue's breasts.
Aye, Jack, I'd say she's cold.
This earned him a cuff on the head from Teresa, who still retained a firm grip on the squirming child.
It's an automaton, Jack,
Matthew said, picking the thing up. When he did, the stag's head sprang open, revealing the hollow chamber within.
This one is meant to run down the Emperor's dinner table. When it stops, the person closest must drink from the stag's neck. Why don't you go show Annie what it does?
He snapped the head back in place and handed the priceless object to Galloglass. Then he gave me a serious look.
We need to talk.
Galloglass propelled Jack and Teresa out of the room with promises of pretzels and skating.
You're in dangerous territory, my love.
Matthew ran his fingers through his hair, which never failed to make him look more handsome.
I've told the congregation that your status as my wife is a convenient fiction to protect you from charges of witchcraft and to keep the Berwick witch hunts confined to Scotland.
But our friends and your fellow vampires know it's more than that, I said. A vampire's sense of smell didn't lie, and Matthew's unique scent covered me. And the witches know there's something more to our relationship than meets even their third eye.
Perhaps, but Rudolph is neither a vampire nor a witch. The Emperor will have been assured by his own contacts within the congregation that there is no relationship between us. Therefore, there is nothing to preclude his chasing after you.
Matthew's fingers found my cheek.
I don't share, Diana. And if Rudolph were to go too far,
you'd keep your temper in check. I covered his hand with mine. You know that I'm not going to let the Holy Roman Emperor, or anybody else for that matter, seduce me. We need Ashmole 782. Who cares if Rudolph stares at my breasts?
Staring I can handle.
Matthew kissed me.
There's something else you should know before you go off to thank the Emperor. The congregation has fed Rudolph's appetites for women and curiosities for some time as a way to win his cooperation. If the Emperor wishes to have you and takes the matter to our other 8 members, their judgment won't be in our favor. The congregation will turn you over to him because they cannot afford to have Prague fall into the hands of men like the Archbishop of Trier and his Jesuit friends.
and they don't want Rudolph to become another King James, out for creature's blood. Prague may appear to be an oasis for the otherworldly, but like all oases, its refuge is a mirage.
I understand, I said. Why did everything touching Matthew have to be so snarled? Our lives reminded me of the knotted cords in my spell box. No matter how many times I picked them apart, they soon tangled again.
Matthew released me. When you go to the palace, take Galloglass with you.
You're not coming?
Given his concerns, I was shocked that Matthew was going to let me out of his sight. No. The more Rudolph sees us together, the more active his imagination and his acquisitiveness will become. And Galloglass just may be able to wheedle his way into Kelly's laboratory. My nephew is far more charming than I am.
Matthew grinned, but the expression did nothing to alleviate the darkness in his eyes. Galloglass insisted he had a plan, one that would keep me from having to speak to Rudolph privately, yet would display my gratitude publicly. It wasn't until I heard the bells ringing the hour of three that I caught my first glimmer of what his plan might entail. The crush of people trying to enter St. Vitus Cathedral through the pointed arches of the side entrance confirmed it.
"There goes Sigismund," Galloglass said, bending close to my ear. The noise from the bells was deafening and I could barely hear him. When I looked at him in confusion, he pointed up to a golden grill on the adjacent steeple.
"Sigismund, the big bell. That's how you know you're in Prague."
St. Vitus Cathedral was textbook Gothic, with its flying buttresses and needle-like pinnacles. On a dark winter afternoon, it was even more so. The candles inside were blazing, but in the vast expanse of the cathedral, they provided nothing more than pinpricks of yellow in the gloom. Outside, the light had faded so much that the colorful stained glass and vivid frescoes were of minimal help in lifting the oppressively heavy atmosphere. Galloglass carefully stationed us under a brace of torches.
"Give your disguising spell a good shake," he suggested. "It's so dark in here that Rudolph might miss you."
"Are you telling me to get shiny?" I gave him my most repressive schoolmarm expression. His only reply was a grin. We waited for Mass to begin with an interesting assortment of humble palace staff, royal officials, and aristocrats. Some of the artisans still bore the stains and singes associated with their work, and most of them looked exhausted. Once I'd surveyed the crowd, I looked up to take in the size and style of the cathedral. "That's a whole lot of vaulting," I murmured. The ribbing was far more complicated than in most Gothic churches in England.
"That's what happens when Matthew gets an idea in his head," Galloglass commented.
"Matthew?" I gaped.
"He was passing through Prague long ago, and Pater Parler, the new architect, was too green for such an important commission. The first outbreak of the plague had killed most of the master masons, however, so Parler was left in charge. Matthew took him under his wing, and the two of them went a bit mad. Can't say I ever understood what he and young Pater were trying to accomplish, but it's eye-catching. Wait until you see what they did to the Great Hall."
I had my mouth open to ask another question when a hush fell over the assembled crowd. Rudolph had arrived. I craned my neck in an effort to see.
"There he is," Galloglass murmured,
jerking his head up and to the right. Rudolph had entered St. Vitus on the second floor from the enclosed walkway that I'd spotted spanning the courtyard between the palace and the cathedral. He was standing on a balcony decorated with colorful heraldic shields celebrating his many titles and honors. Like the ceiling, the balcony was held up by unusually ornate vaulting, though in this case it resembled the gnarled branches of a tree. Based on the breathtaking purity of the cathedral's other architectural supports, I didn't think this was Matthew's work. Rudolph took his seat overlooking the central nave, while the crowd bowed and curtsied in the direction of the royal box. For his part, Rudolph looked uncomfortable at having been noticed. In his private chambers, he was at ease with his courtiers. But here he seemed shy and reserved. He turned to listen to a whispering attendant and caught sight of me. He inclined his head graciously and smiled. The crowd swung around to see whom the Emperor had singled out for his benediction.
curtsy, Galloglass hissed. I dropped down again. We managed to get through the actual mass without incident. I was relieved to find that no one, not even the Emperor, was expected to take the sacrament, and the whole ceremony was over quickly. At some point, Rudolph quietly slipped away to his private apartments, no doubt to pore over his treasures. With the Emperor and priests gone, the nave turned into a cheerful gathering place as friends exchanged news and gossip. I spotted Ottavio Strada in the distance, deep in conversation with a florid gentleman in expensive woolen robes. Dr. Hayek was here too, laughing and talking to a young couple who were obviously in love. I smiled at him, and he made a small bow in my direction. Strada I could do without, but I liked the Emperor's physician.
Galloglass, shouldn't you be hibernating like the rest of the bears?
A slight man with deep-set eyes approached, his mouth twisted into a wry smile. He was wearing simple, expensive clothes, and the gold ring on his fingers spoke of his prosperity.
We should all be hibernating in this weather. It is good to see you in such health, Yoris.
Galloglass clasped his hand and struck him on the back. The man's eyes popped at the force of the blow.
I would say the same about you, but since you are always healthy, I will spare us both the empty courtesy.
The man turned to me.
And here is La Diosa.
Diana, I said, bobbing a greeting.
That is not your name here. Rudolph calls you La Diosa de la Casa. It is Spanish for the goddess of the chase. The Emperor has commanded poor Master Spronger to abandon his latest sketches of Venus in her bath in favor of a new subject. Diana interrupted at her toilette. We all wait eagerly to see if Spronger is capable of making such an enormous change on such short notice.
The man bowed.
Yoris Hufnagel.
The calligrapher, I said, thinking back to Pierre's remark about the ornate penmanship on Matthew's official summons to Rudolph's court. But that name was familiar.
The artist, Galloglass corrected gently.
La Diosa.
A gaunt man swept his hat off with scarred hands.
I am Erasmus Habermel. Would you be so kind as to visit my workshop as soon as you're able? His Majesty would like you to have an astronomical compendium so as to better note the changes in the fickle moon, but it must be exactly to your liking.
Habermel was a familiar name, too.
She is coming to me tomorrow.
A portly man in his 30s pushed his way through the growing crowd. His accent was distinctly Italian.
La Diosa is to sit for a portrait. His Majesty wishes to have her likeness engraved in stone as a symbol of her permanence in his affections.
Perspiration broke out on his upper lip.
Signor Miseroni,
another Italian said, clasping his hands melodramatically to his heaving chest.
I thought we understood each other. La Diosa must practice her dance if she is to take part in the entertainment next week as the Emperor wishes.
He bowed in my direction.
I am Alfonso Passetti, La Diosa, His Majesty's dancing master.
But my wife does not like to dance, said a cool voice behind me. A long arm snaked around and took my hand, which was fiddling with the edge of my bodice.
Do you, mon coeur?
This last endearment was accompanied by a kiss on the knuckles and a warning nip of teeth.
Matthew is right on cue, as always, Yoris said with a hearty laugh. How are you?
Disappointed not to find Diana at home, Matthew said in a slightly aggrieved tone. But even a devoted husband must yield to God in his wife's affections.
Hufnagel watched Matthew closely, gauging every change of expression. I suddenly realized who this was. The great artist who was such an acute observer of nature that his illustrations of flora and fauna seemed as though they, like the creatures on Mary's shoes, could come to life.
Well, God is done with her for today. I think you are free to take your wife home,
Hufnagel said mildly.
You promised to enliven what would otherwise be a very dull spring, La Diosa. For that we are all grateful.
The men dispersed after getting assurances from Galloglass that he would keep track of my varied conflicting appointments. Hoofnagle was the last to leave.
I will keep an eye out for your wife, Skadu. Perhaps you should too.
My attention is always on my wife where it belongs. How else did I know to be here?
Of course, forgive my meddling. The forest has ears and the fields have eyes.
Hoofnagle bowed. I will see you at court, La Diosa.
Her name is Diana, Matthew said tightly. Madame de Clermont will also serve.
And here I was led to understand it was Royden. My mistake.
Hoofnagle took a few steps backward.
Good evening, Matthew.
His footsteps echoed on the stone floors and faded into silence.
Skadu? I asked. Does that mean what it sounds like?
It's Dutch for shadow. Elizabeth isn't the only person to call me by that name.
Matthew looked to Galloglass.
What is this entertainment Signor Passetti mentioned?
Oh, nothing out of the ordinary. It will no doubt be mythological in theme, with terrible music and even worse dancing. Having had too much to drink, the courtiers will all stumble into the wrong bedchambers at the end of the night. 9 months later, there will be a flock of noble babes of uncertain parentage, the usual.
Sic transit gloria mundi, Matthew murmured. He bowed to me. Shall we go home, La Diosa?
The nickname made me uncomfortable when strangers used it, but when it came out of Matthew's mouth, it was almost unbearable.
Jack tells me that tonight's stew is particularly appetizing.
Matthew was distant all evening, watching me with heavy eyes as I heard about the children's day and Pierre brought him up to date on various happenings in Prague. The names were unfamiliar and the narrative so confusing that I gave up trying to follow it and went to bed. Jack's cries woke me, and I rushed to him only to discover that Matthew had already reached the boy. He was wild, thrashing and crying out for help.
"My bones are flying apart," he kept saying. "It hurts! It hurts!"
Matthew bundled him up tight against his chest so that he couldn't move.
"Shh, I've got you now."
He continued to hold Jack until only faint tremors radiated through the child's slender limbs.
"All the monsters look like ordinary men tonight, Master Royden," Jack told him, snuggling deeper into my husband's arms.
He sounded exhausted, and there were blue smudges under his eyes that made him look far older than his years.
"They often do, Jack," Matthew said. "They often do."
The next few weeks were a whirlwind of appointments, with the Emperor's jeweler, the Emperor's instrument maker, and the Emperor's dancing master. Each encounter took me deeper into the heart of the huddle of buildings that composed the Imperial Palace, to workshops and residences that were reserved for Rudolph's prize artists and intellectuals. Between engagements, Galloglass took me to parts of the palace that I had not yet seen. To the menagerie, where Rudolph kept his leopards and lions, much as he kept his limners and musicians on the narrow streets east of the cathedral. To the stag moat, which had been altered so that Rudolph could enjoy better sport. To the sgraffito-covered games hall, where courtiers could take their exercise. To the new greenhouses built to protect the Emperor's precious fig trees from the harsh Bohemian winter. But there was one place where not even Galloglass could gain admission. The Powder Tower, where Edward Kelly worked over his alembics and crucibles in an attempt to make the Philosopher's Stone. We stood outside it and tried to talk our way past the guards stationed at the entrance. Galloglass even resorted to bellowing a hearty greeting. It brought the neighbors running to see if there was a fire, but didn't elicit a reaction from Dr. D's erstwhile assistant. "It's as if he's a prisoner," I told Matthew after the supper dishes were cleared and Jack and Annie were safely tucked into their beds. They'd enjoyed another exhausting round of skating, sledding, and pretzels. We'd given up the pretense that they were our servants. I hoped the opportunity to behave like a normal 8-year-old boy would help to end Jack's nightmares. But the palace was no place for them. I was terrified they might wander off and get lost forever, unable to speak the language or tell people to whom they belonged.
Kelly is a prisoner, Matthew said, toying with the stem of his goblet. It was heavy silver and glinted in the firelight. They say he goes home occasionally, usually in the middle of the night when there's no one around to see. At least he gets some relief from the Emperor's constant demands.
You haven't met Mistress Kelly, Matthew said dryly.
I hadn't, which struck me as odd the more I considered it. Perhaps I was taking the wrong route to meet the alchemist. I'd allowed myself to be swept into court life with the hope of knocking on Kelly's laboratory door and walking straight in to demand Ashmole 782. But given my new familiarity with courtly life, such a direct approach was unlikely to succeed. The next morning, I made it a point to go with Teresa to do the shopping. It was absolutely frigid outside and the wind was fierce, but we trudged to the market nonetheless.
"Do you know my countrywoman, Mistress Kelly?"
I asked Frau Huber as we waited for the baker to wrap our purchases. The housewives of Malastrana collected the bizarre and unusual as avidly as Rudolph did. Her husband is one of the Emperor's servants.
"One of the Emperor's caged alchemists, you mean," Frau Huber said with a snort. "There are always odd things happening in that household. And it was worse when the D's were here. Herr Kelly was always looking at Frau D with lust."
"And Mistress Kelly?" I prompted her.
"She does not go out much. Her cook does the shopping."
Frau Huber did not approve of this delegation of housewifely responsibility. It opened the door to all sorts of disorder, including, she contended, Anabaptism and a thriving black market in purloined kitchen staples. She had made her feelings on this point clear at our first meeting, and it was one of the chief reasons I went out in all weathers to buy cabbage.
"Are we discussing the alchemist's wife?" Signorina Rossi said, tripping across the frozen stones and narrowly avoiding a wheelbarrow full of coal. "She is English, and therefore very strange, and her wine bills are much larger than they should be."
"How do you two know so much?" I asked when I'd finished laughing.
"We share the same laundress,"
Frau Huber said, surprised.
"None of us have any secrets from our laundresses," Signora Rossi agreed. "She did the washing for the D's, too, until Signora D fired her for charging so much to clean the napkins."
"A difficult woman, Jane D, but you could not fault her thrift," Frau Huber admitted with a sigh.
"Why do you need to see Mistress Kelly?"
Signorina Rossi inquired, stowing a braided loaf of bread in her basket.
"I want to meet her husband. I'm interested in alchemy and have some questions."
"Will you pay?" Frau Huber asked, rubbing her fingers together in a universal and apparently timeless gesture.
"For what?" I said, confused.
"His answers, of course."
"Yes," I agreed, wondering what devious plan she was concocting.
"Leave it to me," Frau Huber said. "I am hungry for schnitzel, and the Austrian who owns the tavern near your house, Frau Reuden, knows what schnitzel should be."
The Austrian schnitzel wizard's teenage daughter, it turned out, shared a tutor with Kelly's 10-year-old stepdaughter, Elizabeth, and his cook was married to the laundress's aunt, whose sister-in-law helped out around the Kelly's house. It was thanks to this occult chain of relationships forged by women, and not Galloglass's court connections, that Matthew and I found ourselves in the Kelly's second-floor parlor at midnight, waiting for the great man to arrive.
"He should be here at any moment," Joanna Kelly assured us.
Her eyes were red-rimmed and bleary, though whether this resulted from too much wine or from the cold that seemed to afflict the entire household was not clear.
"Do not trouble yourself on our account, Mistress Kelly. We keep late hours," Matthew said smoothly, giving her a dazzling smile.
"And how do you like your new house?" After much espionage and investigation among the Austrian and Italian communities, we discovered that the Kellys had recently purchased a house around the corner from the Three Ravens in a complex known for its inventive street sign. Someone had taken a few leftover wooden figures from a nativity scene, sawed them in half, and arranged them on a board. They had, in the process, removed the infant Jesus from his creche and replaced it with the head of Mary's donkey.
"The donkey and cradle meets our needs at present, Master Royden."
Mistress Kelly issued forth an awe-inspiring sneeze and took a swig of wine.
We had thought the Emperor would set aside a house for us in the palace itself, given Edward's work, but this will do.
A regular thumping sounded on the winding stairs.
Here is Edward.
A walking staff appeared first, then a stained hand, followed by an equally stained sleeve. The rest of Edward Kelly looked just as disreputable. His long beard was unkempt and stuck out from a dark skullcap that hid his ears. If he'd had a hat, it was gone now. And he was fond of his dinners, gauging by his Falstaffian proportions. Kelly limped into the room whistling, then froze at the sight of Matthew.
Edward.
Matthew rewarded the man with another of those dazzling smiles, but Kelly didn't seem nearly as pleased to receive it as his wife had.
Imagine us meeting again so far from home.
How did you?
Edward said hoarsely. He looked around the room, and his eyes fell on me with a nudging glance that was as insidious as any I'd felt from a demon. But there was more. Disturbances in the threads that surrounded him, irregularities in the weaving that suggested he was not just demonic, he was unstable. His lips curled.
The witch.
The Emperor has elevated her rank, just as he did yours. She is La Diosa, the goddess, now, Matthew said. Do sit down and rest your leg. It troubles you in the cold, as I remember.
What business do you have with me, Royden?
Edward Kelly gripped his staff tighter.
He is here on behalf of the Queen, Edward. I was in my bed,
Joanna said plaintively.
I get so little rest, and because of this dreadful ague, I have not yet met our neighbors. You did not tell me there were English people living so close. Why, I can see Mistress Royden's house from the tower window. You are at the castle. I am alone, longing to speak my native tongue, and yet—
Go back to bed, my dear, Kelly said, dismissing Joanna. Take your wine with you.
Mrs. Kelly sniffed off obligingly, her expression miserable. To be an Englishwoman in Prague without friends or family was difficult, but to have your husband welcome in places where you were forbidden to go must make it doubly so. When she was gone, Kelly clumped over to the table and sat down in his wife's chair. With a grimace, he lifted his leg into place. Then he pinned his dark, hostile eyes on Matthew.
Tell me what I must do to get rid of you, he said bluntly.
Kelly might have Kit's cunning, but he had none of his charm.
The Queen wants you, Matthew said, equally blunt. We want Dee's book. Which book?
Edward's reply was quick. Too quick.
For a charlatan, you are an abominable liar, Kelly.
How do you manage to take them all in?
Matthew swung his long, booted legs onto the table. Kelly cringed when the heels struck the surface.
If Dr. Dee is accusing me of theft, Kelly blustered, then I must insist on discussing this matter in the Emperor's presence. He would not want me treated thus, my honor impugned in my own house. Where is it, Kelly? In your laboratory? In Rudolph's bedchamber? I will find it with or without your help. But if you were to tell me your secret, I might be inclined to let the other matter rest.
Matthew picked at a speck on his breeches.
The congregation is not pleased with your recent behavior.
Kelly's staff clattered to the floor. Matthew obligingly picked it up. He touched the worn end to Kelly's neck.
Is this where you touched the tapster at the inn when you threatened his life? That was careless, Edward. All this pomp and privilege has gone to your head.
The staff dropped down to Kelly's considerable belly and rested there.
I cannot help you, Kelly winced, as Matthew increased the pressure on the stick. It is the truth. The Emperor took the book from me when—
Kelly trailed off, rubbing his hand across his face as if to erase the vampire sitting across from him. When what? I said, leaning forward. When I touched Ashmole 782 in the Bodleian, I'd immediately known it was different.
You must know more about this book than I do,
Kelly spit at me, his eyes blazing.
You witches were not surprised to hear of its existence, though it took a demon to recognize it.
I am losing my patience, Edward.
The wooden staff cracked in Matthew's hands.
My wife asked you a question. Answer it.
Kelly gave Matthew a slow, triumphant look and pushed at the end of the staff, dislodging it from his abdomen.
You hate witches, or so everyone believes. But I see now that you share Gerbert's weakness for the creatures. You're in love with this one, just as I told Rudolph.
Gerbert.
Matthew's tone was flat. Kelly nodded.
He came when Dee was still in Prague, asking questions about the book and nosing around in my business. Rudolph let him enjoy one of the witches from the old town, a 17-year-old girl and very pretty, with rosy hair and blue eyes, just like your wife. No one has seen her since. But there was a very fine fire that Walpurgis night. Gerbert was given the honor of lighting it.
Kelly shifted his eyes to me.
I wonder if we will have a fire again this year.
The mention of the ancient tradition of burning a witch to celebrate spring was the final straw for Matthew. He had Kelly half out the window by the time I realized what was happening.
Look down, Edward. It is not a steep fall. You would survive it, I fear, though you might break a bone or two. I would collect you and take you up to your bedchamber. That has a window too, no doubt. Eventually, I will find a place that is high enough to snap your sorry carcass in two. By then, every bone in your body will be in pieces, and you will have told me what I want to know.
Matthew turned black eyes on me when I rose.
Sit down.
He took a deep breath.
Please.
I did.
Dee's book shimmered with power. I could smell it the moment he pulled it off the shelf at Mortlake. He was oblivious to its significance, but I knew.
Kelly couldn't talk fast enough now. When he paused to take a breath, Matthew shook him.
The witch Roger Bacon owned it and valued it for a great treasure. His name is on the title page, along with the inscription, Virum Secretum Secretorum.
But it's nothing like the Secretum, I said, thinking of the popular medieval work. That's an encyclopedia. This has alchemical illustrations.
The illustrations are nothing but a screen against the truth, Kelly said, wheezing. That is why Bacon called it the true secret of secrets.
What does it say? I asked, rising with excitement. This time Matthew didn't warn me off. He also dragged Kelly back inside. Were you able to read the words?
Perhaps,
Kelly said, straightening his robe.
He couldn't read the book either.
Matthew released Kelly with disgust. I can smell the duplicity through his fear.
It's written in a foreign tongue. Not even Rabbi Lowe could decipher it.
The Maharal has seen the book?
Matthew had that still, alert look that he got just before he pounced.
Apparently you didn't ask Rabbi Lowe about it when you were in the Jewish town to seek out the witch who made this clay creature they call the golem. Nor could you find the culprit and his creation.
Kelly looked contemptuous.
So much for your famous power and influence. You couldn't even frighten the Jews.
I don't think the words are Hebrew, I said, remembering the fast-moving symbols I'd glimpsed in the palimpsest.
They aren't. The Emperor had Rabbi Lowe come to the palace just to be sure.
Kelly had revealed more than he'd intended. His eyes shifted to his staff, and the threads around him warped and twisted. An image came to me of Kelly lifting his staff to strike someone. What was he up to? Then I realized he was planning on striking me. An unintelligible sound broke free from my mouth, and when I held out my hand, Kelly's staff flew straight into it. My arm transformed into a branch for a moment before returning to its normal outlines. I prayed that it had all happened too fast for Kelly to perceive the change. The look on his face told me my hopes were in vain.
Don't let the Emperor see you do that, Kelly smirked, or he'll have you locked away. Yet another curiosity for him to savor. I've told you what you wanted to know, Royden. Call off the congregation's dogs.
I don't think I can, Matthew said, taking the staff from me. You are not harmless, no matter what Gerbert thinks. But I'll leave you alone. For now. Don't do anything more to warrant my attention, and you just may see the summer.
He tossed the staff into the corner. Good night, Master Kelly. I gathered up my cloak, wanting to be as far away from the demon as possible.
Enjoy your moment in the sun, witch. It passed quickly in Prague.
Kelly remained where he was while Matthew and I started to descend the stairs. I could still feel his nudging glances in the street. And when I looked back toward the donkey and cradle, the crooked and broken threads that bound Kelly to the world shimmered with malevolence. Chapter 29. After days of careful negotiation, Matthew was able to arrange a visit to Rabbi Yehuda Lowe. To make room for it, Galloglass had to cancel my upcoming appointments at court, citing illness. Unfortunately, this announcement caught the Emperor's attention, and the house was flooded with medicines. Terra sigillata, the clay with marvelous healing properties. Bezoar stones harvested from the gallbladders of goats to ward off poison. A cup made of unicorn horn with one of the Emperor's family recipes for an electuary. The latter involved roasting an egg with saffron before beating it into a powder with mustard seed, angelica, juniper berries, camphor, and several other mysterious substances, then turning it into a paste with treacle and lemon syrup. Rudolf sent Dr. Hayek along to administer it. But I had no intention of swallowing this unappetizing concoction, as I informed the Imperial physician.
"I will assure the Emperor that you will recover," he said dryly. "Happily, His Majesty is too concerned with his own health to risk traveling down Sporengasse to confirm my prognosis."
We thanked him profusely for his discretion and sent him home with one of the roasted chickens that had been delivered from the royal kitchens to tempt my appetite. I threw the note that accompanied it into the fire.
"Ich versprechen, Sie werden nicht hungern. Ich halte euch zufrieden, Rudolf."
After Matthew explained that the wording left some doubt as to whether Rudolf was referring to the chicken when he promised to satisfy my hunger. On our way across the Moldau River to Prague's old town, I had my first opportunity to experience the hustle and bustle of the city center. There, affluent merchants conducted business in arcades nestled beneath the 3- and 4-story houses that lined the twisting streets. When we turned north, the city's character changed. The houses were smaller, the residents more shabbily dressed, the businesses less prosperous. Then we crossed over a wide street and passed through a gate into the Jewish town. More than 5,000 Jews lived in this small enclave, smashed between the industrial riverbank, the old town's main square, and a convent. The Jewish quarter was crowded, inconceivably so, even by London standards, with houses that were not so much constructed as grown, each structure evolving organically from the walls of another like the chambers of a snail shell. We found Rabbi Lowe via a serpentine route that made me long for a bag of breadcrumbs to be sure we could find our way back. The residents slid cautious glances in our direction, but few dared to greet us. Those who did called Matthew Gabriel. It was one of his many names, and the use of it here signaled that I'd slipped down one of Matthew's rabbit holes and was about to meet another of his past selves. When I stood before the kindly gentleman known as the Maharal, I understood why Matthew spoke of him in hushed tones. Rabbi Lowe radiated the same quiet sense of power that I'd seen in Philippe. His dignity made Rudolph's grandiose gestures and Elizabeth's petulance seem laughable in comparison. And it was all the more striking in this age, when brute force was the usual method of imposing one's will on others. The Maharal's reputation was based on scholarship and learning, not physical prowess. "The Maharal is one of the finest men who has ever lived," Matthew said simply when I asked him to tell me more about Yehuda Lowe. Considering how long Matthew had roamed the earth, this was a considerable accolade.
"I did think, Gabriel, that we had concluded our business,"
Rabbi Lowe said sternly in Latin. He looked and sounded very much like a headmaster.
I would not share the name of the witch who made the golem before, and I will not do so now.
Rabbi Lowe turned to me.
I am sorry, Frau Royden. My impatience with your husband made me forget my manners. It is a pleasure to meet you.
I haven't come about the golem, Matthew replied. My business today is private. It concerns a book.
What book is that?
Though the Maharal didn't blink, a disturbance in the air around me suggested some subtle reaction on his part. Since meeting Kelly, I realized that my magic had been tingling as though plugged into an invisible current. My fire drake was stirring. And the threads surrounding me kept bursting into color, highlighting an object, a person, a path through the streets as if trying to tell me something.
It is a volume my wife found at a university far away from here, Matthew said.
I was surprised that he was being this truthful. So was Rabbi Lowe.
Ah, I see we are to be honest with each other this afternoon. We should do so where it is quiet enough for me to enjoy the experience. Come into my study.
He led us into one of the small rooms tucked into the warren of a ground floor. It was comfortingly familiar, with its scarred desk and piles of books. I recognized the smell of ink and something that reminded me of the rosin box in my childhood dance studio. An iron pot by the door held what looked like small brown apples, bobbing up and down in an equally brown liquid. Its appearance was witch-worthy, conjuring up concerns about what else might be lurking in the cauldron's unsavory depths.
"Is this batch of ink more satisfactory?" Matthew said, poking at one of the floating balls. "It is. You've done me a service by telling me to add those nails to the pot. It does not require so much soot to make it black, and the consistency is better."
Rabbi Lowe gestured toward a chair.
"Please sit."
He waited until I was settled, and then took the only other seat, a three-legged stool.
"Gabriel will stand. He's not young, but his legs are strong." "I'm young enough to sit at your feet like one of your pupils, Maharal."
Matthew grinned and folded himself gracefully into a cross-legged position.
"My students have better sense than to take to the floor in this weather."
Rabbi Lowe studied me.
"Now, to business. Why has the wife of Gabriel ben Ariel come so far to look for a book?"
I had a disconcerting sense that he wasn't talking about my trip across the river or even across Europe. How could he possibly know that I wasn't from this time? As soon as my mind formed the question, a man's face swam in the air over Rabbi Lowe's shoulder. The face, though young, already showed worry creases around deep-set gray eyes, and the dark brown beard was graying in the center of his chin. "Another witch told you about me," I said softly. Rabbi Lowe nodded.
"Prague is a wonderful city for news. Alas, half of what is said is untrue."
He waited for a moment.
"The book?"
Rabbi Lowe reminded me. "We think it might tell us about how creatures like Matthew and me came to be," I explained.
"This is not a mystery. God made you, just as he made me and Emperor Rudolf," the Maharal replied, settling more deeply into his chair.
It was a typical posture for a teacher, one that developed naturally after years spent giving students the space to wrestle with new ideas. I felt a familiar sense of anticipation and dread as I prepared my response. I didn't want to disappoint Rabbi Lowe. "Perhaps. But God has given some of us additional talents." "You cannot make the dead live again, Rabbi Lowe," I said, responding to him as if he were a tutor at Oxford. "Nor do strange faces appear before you when you pose a simple question."
"True. But you do not rule Bohemia, and your husband's German is better than mine, even though I've conversed in the language since a child. Each of us is uniquely gifted, Frau Royden. In the world's apparent chaos, there is still evidence of God's plan."
"You speak of God's plan with such confidence because you know your origins from the Torah," I replied. "Bereshit, in the beginning, is what you call the book the Christians know as Genesis. Isn't that right, Rabbi Lowe?"
It seems I have been discussing theology with the wrong member of Ariel's family,
Rabbi Lowe said dryly, though his eyes twinkled with mischief. Who is Ariel? I asked.
My father is known as Ariel among Rabbi Lowe's people, Matthew explained.
The Angel of Wrath? I frowned. That didn't sound like the Philippe I knew.
The Lord with dominion over the earth. Some call him the Lion of Jerusalem. Recently, my people have had reason to be grateful to the Lion. Though the Jews have not and will never forget his many past wrongs. But Ariel makes an effort to atone, and judgment belongs to God.
Rabbi Lowe considered his options and came to a decision.
The Emperor did show me such a book. Alas, His Majesty did not give me much time to study it. Anything you could tell us about it would be useful, Matthew said, his excitement visible.
He leaned forward and hugged his knees to his chest, just as Jack did when he was listening intently to one of Pierre's stories. For a few moments, I was able to see my husband as he must have looked as a child learning the carpenter's craft.
Emperor Rudolf called me to his palace in hope that I would be able to read the text. The alchemist, the one they call Meshuggah Edward, had it from the library of his master, the Englishman John Dee.
Rabbi Lowe sighed and shook his head.
It's difficult to understand why God chose to make Dee learned but foolish and Edward ignorant yet cunning. Meshuggah Edward told the Emperor that this ancient book contained the secrets of immortality.
Lowe continued.
To live forever is every powerful man's dream. But the text was written in a language no one understood, except for the alchemist.
Rudolf called upon you, thinking it was an ancient form of Hebrew, I said, nodding.
It may well be ancient, but it's not Hebrew. There were pictures, too. I did not understand the meaning, but Edward said they were alchemical in nature. Perhaps the words explained those images.
When you saw it, Rabbi Lowe, were the words moving? I asked, thinking back to the lines I'd seen lurking under the alchemical illustrations.
How could they be moving?
Lowe frowned.
They were just symbols written in ink on the page.
Then it isn't broken. Not yet, I said, relieved. Someone removed several pages from it before I saw it in Oxford. It was impossible to figure out the text's meaning because the words were racing around looking for their lost brothers and sisters.
You make it sound as though this book is alive,
Rabbi Lowe said. I think it is, I confessed. Matthew looked surprised. It sounds unbelievable, I know. But when I think back to that night and what happened when I touched the book, that's the only way to describe it. The book recognized me. It was hurting somehow, as though it had lost something essential.
There are stories among my people of books written in living flame, with words that move and twist so that only those chosen by God can read them.
Rabbi Lowe was testing me again. I recognized the signs of a teacher quizzing his students. I've heard those stories, I replied slowly. And the stories about other lost books, too. The tablets Moses destroyed. Adam's book, in which he recorded the true names of every part of creation.
If your book is as significant as they are, perhaps it's God's will that it remain hidden.
Rabbi Lowe sat back once more and waited. But it's not hidden, I said. Rudolf knows where it is, even if he cannot read it. Who would you rather had the custody of such a powerful object? Matthew or the Emperor?
I know many wise men who would say that to choose between Gabriel ben Ariel and His Majesty would only determine the lesser of two evils.
Rabbi Lowe's attention shifted to Matthew.
Happily, I do not count myself among them. Still, I cannot help you further. I have seen this book, but I do not know its present location. The book is in Rudolf's possession, or at least it was. Until you confirmed that, we only had Dr. D's suspicions and the assurances of the aptly named Crazy Edward, Matthew said grimly. Madmen can be dangerous,
observed Rabbi Low. You should be more careful who you hang out of windows, Gabriel.
You heard about that? Matthew looked sheepish.